Hey, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which is basically a live stream broadcast that comes to you in one form or another, usually 3 weekdays per week at on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. On Tuesdays, it's produced by Peter Werby, and it's called Fifth Estate Live. And on Wednesday and Friday, it's produced by me, and it's called Discussions with David. But I host the 3 weekly interview shows, and you might be watching on various platforms. We're broadcasting on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio, along with my own Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, VK, Twitch, and LinkedIn accounts. And it goes out in podcast form afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. And today we are spending the hour with somebody else who has a podcast, who interviews people regularly for Joe Public Speaking is the name of his podcast. And for longer than he's had a podcast, he's been a filmmaker. And you can at Joe Public Films is his filmmaking enterprise, joepublicfilms.com. And the first film that he made that I was aware of is called Greetings from Missile Street, a very powerful film about the impact of sanctions on Iraq way back about 20 years ago. And since then, he's made a whole bunch of other fantastic documentaries. And with no further ado, I'm just going to bring onto the screen here Tom Jackson in New Hampshire.
Hi, David.
Great to see you.
Good morning to you.
How did you get into the podcasting? Was this a pandemic affliction, or did it start before then?
It was a pandemic. It was definitely a sort of thing that I decided I could do during the stay at home period. And you know, I had been on the radio off and on actually since I was in high school. Which you can tell by the white hair, that was a long time ago. And so I felt confident in that respect, you know, in terms of making audio files and that sort of thing. And also the fact that, you know, with the video production, I mean, I had a couple of things in progress in terms of documentary video projects, and also a couple of like small scale advertisements that I had committed to. Oh, and a music video that I committed to making. But, you know, then along comes Mr. COVID, and nobody wants to like go out and shoot video and get together and be exposed in that respect. And that's still pretty much the case. But yeah, so I decided, you know, Why not join the crowd? As podcasting, for as long as it's been around, it's become tremendously popular, as you know. And I thought maybe I could kind of bring in some ideas and some issues that were more ignored than ever. Just because, you know, everything in the news, even some progressive news outlets, were Trump, 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 or COVID, COVID, COVID. Not that those things aren't important in various ways, but I felt as though there were a lot of other things that they weren't getting any attention if they ever had. Actually, the first thing I did for the podcast was a series of interviews with people who are working on the addiction and recovery issue. It's here in New Hampshire where I live. The opioid issue, of course, has been a big thing for a long time. During the pandemic and the shutdown and everything, it's gotten worse from what I understand. I felt like those voices still need to get out there. And so this was a way to try to help to do that.
This, and compared with filmmaking, in terms of the different sorts of art forms, from recording an album of music to making a documentary to putting out a podcast, I mean, filmmaking involves the highest amount of overhead and the most amount of work and the biggest budgets and the most number of people involved. I mean, it's like compared to being a solo acoustic artist or something. It's like the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of complexity and how much, I mean, was that also, I guess the pandemic itself also would be such a force to encourage you to do activities that you can do by yourself in your house, like podcasting, how many more podcasts you can put out compared to films. I don't know if you think of it that way, but in terms of like how many people, do you feel like you're reaching as many or fewer people through the podcasts compared to when you put out a film, or is it hard to compare?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, I'm still hopeful that the audience for the podcast will continue to grow. I mean, it has, you know, it's reached progressively more people as it's gone along. And the great thing about podcasts is, you know, you can always archive them and people can go back and listen to one that you did a few months ago. And that does happen. But it would be nice if, you know, to continue to grow the listenership. I think it's been listened to in something like 35 different countries now, which that's kind of cool, but you know, I'd like that to continue to grow as well.
Utah Phillips used to say, "I'm famous among dozens worldwide."
I love it. I actually met him at a film festival that Out of Balance, a climate change doc that I directed about 14 years ago.
Wait, climate change stock? Did you say no?
Doc.
Oh, okay. Okay. It wasn't like some kind of a, okay. Got it. Right.
No. wasn't a shareholders meeting.
Okay. Or some kind of weird Woodstock takeoff. I was just, you know, cause when people put stock at the end, no, doc, got it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, he was at, I think the film festival, I believe he lived in Nevada City, California, and he was there at this film festival, and I got to go up and meet him and chat with him a little bit. And which was really cool because I had known who he was for years.
Yeah. Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And what surprised me about meeting him was that he speaks like that. You know, it's not a stage act. Like all this hobo vocabulary, he actually uses it in daily language. And so like trying to even follow everything he was saying, I was like, what? I know what a bindle stiff is. I know he said bindle stiff in one of his recordings. So
yeah,
I'm pretty sure I learned from him what a bindle stiff was. So I was glad I had listened to his recordings before I actually heard him speak in normal language, over breakfast, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, getting back to your question, you are correct that the podcast, especially nowadays, you know, producing it over Zoom, where I feel like I live pretty much a lot of the time, is definitely easier. It's, you know, in terms of labor intensity, in terms of, you know, having funding and so on. So in that respect, it's been a relatively easy thing. You do have to kind of invest some time into it, because, you know, I always, if I'm not that familiar with, say, the writing or whatever of someone who I get interested in having on the show, then I still like to do my homework the way I always did with documentary videos. And, you know, read as much by them as I can find, see if I can find videos, you know, of interviews with them previously on YouTube or something like that, and just really try to study up and, you know as much as I can about them.
You can do a lot of work, a lot of research to do one interview that might be listened to by dozens of people. I mean, it's such a struggle, isn't it, with the whole content thing? I mean, there's just such massive amounts of content out there. And then the question of how anybody survives at this kind of doing this kind of thing, like producing, no matter how good it is, you know, producing any kind of content, be it music or films or podcasts or, you know, things with really high production values or not. I mean, there's just so much out there all the time, right? I mean, I've been reading, I'm actually next week, I'm interviewing a an author of a recently published book called The Death of the Artist. And it is just really quite something to see, like to go through all the different types of art and how much each one has been sort of attacked by vulture capitalist corporations like Spotify and Amazon that have just like really sought to destroy the industry and reshape it in their image and make it profitable for them and almost nobody else. And but he writes about how TV has been kind of the exception to the rule in terms of all the arts, where everybody's, if they're finding work as a musician or as a former filmmaker or any number of other things, they're finding it in television because there's a lot of content being produced for all these different streaming platforms and that are competing with each other for the audience and everything. And is that something that you've... I mean, it's a huge question. I'm not looking for a one short answer to it, but over the course of the past 20 years of you making films, more than 20 years, the industry in all the forms of the arts, I'd say it's fair to say, has radically transformed multiple times. And certainly that's true with music. I'm sure it's true with filmmaking. And then has the TV been one of those routes that you've considered going into, like trying to actually get a job doing that kind of thing? Or is that how much of a enticement is that whole reality for you in recent years as that's been happening?
That's a good question. In recent years, probably not as much. But a couple of things come to mind. I mean, two of my documentaries, Greetings from Missile Street, which you mentioned before, and Out of Balance, which is the climate change documentary.
But ExxonMobil, focusing on ExxonMobil.
Yeah, mm-hmm. expose of ExxonMobil and their escapades. Those were both aired on television stations, satellite TV network, you know, stations. So Missile Street was on Free Speech TV a bunch of times because that was kind of in their early days. And Out of Balance was on Telesur. And they captioned it in Spanish because, you know, they're a Spanish-speaking network that's seen around the world. It was kind of nice.
Yeah.
And Link TV aired it a number of times and actually used it as a fundraising perk for their annual fund drive. I think that was 2008. And, you know, so, and I was of course pleased that TV networks like that, were interested in airing it. I didn't really think about trying to, get work with a TV network until about 2010. And then I actually was offered a job with none other than CCTV in China.
CCTV in China. Oh, interesting. What's that? CCTV. Well, that's their main,
that's
like
their
main party.
Yeah, you know, government network.
So what kind of job were they offering you?
Well, I had found a job, along with a bunch of other, you know, TV related jobs. It was a producer position. I found it online somewhere. I don't remember exactly where it was at this point, but you know, I thought they were doing some, it was for their English language network that they have. And I thought, I wouldn't mind being a producer at a television network and, you know, I mean, why not give it a shot? And so they did wind up offering me a position, but then a few days after they offered the position, they left me a phone message in the middle of the night saying that we've decided that we want to make you a host of this sort of like current sort of cultural, you know, let's go around China and look at different places that are developing. And I told them I didn't apply to be a host and I'm not really interested in that. You know, I would like to be a producer as I interviewed for. And, you know, long story short, in the end, I didn't wind up going over there. So since then, I haven't really, I've been I've been teaching quite a bit as a sort of bread and butter type thing, and continuing to produce documentary videos. And, you know, I mean, that's not something that I have any intention of ever scrapping or, you know, retiring from or anything like that. Hopefully when it gets a little bit safer, hopefully that time will come fairly soon to actually go out and do the production side of things. You know, my intention is to continue with that type of work and also the podcast. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, then drop the podcast, even if the listenership isn't, you know, really super substantial or whatever. That's just something that I like to do in addition to feeling as though, you know, there's the potential there to be part of getting some voices out that are, you know, largely ignored, certainly by mainstream media.
I mean, during the pandemic, doing this interview show is just about the only way I have adult conversation with anybody other than my wife. I don't know how it is, you know, for you, but I think it's like that for a lot of people. If I didn't do this, I would be talking to my little children, and you know, yeah, that'd be about that. But when you put out Greetings for Missile Street, and I mean, you got. It was a fantastic documentary, but you got quite a lot of really positive attention for it. And I wonder how much of that was due to the fact that it was a great documentary, and how much of that was due to the fact that there was an anti-war movement that was really going strong for a few years immediately pretty much immediately following the release. And then also, but I know you might not know the answer. These might be rhetorical questions, but also I wonder, putting out documentaries post YouTube as opposed to pre YouTube, how different is that experience?
Because
that was all pre YouTube. Greetings for Missile Street. I mean, some of the awards came in at post YouTube, but basically it was a pre YouTube affair for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Wow. So, you know, it was. The video was shot mostly in 2000, spring and summer of 2000, and then edited in Chicago at Media Process Group, which is a filmmaker named Bob Hercules. That's his studio in Chicago, and an editor named Jan Muller worked with me on an Avid suite, which was not something I was familiar with at that point. And it was done in...
Is that the type of software?
Well, yeah, software and hardware, really, the Avid suite. And there's still, you know, TV stations and other studios that use that type of thing, as opposed to Premiere or Final Cut or something like that. We finished, I think it was actually May 1st of 2001 that it was finally like, okay, that's it. You know, we're putting this out. And you're right. At first it got, I mean, it's kind of a mixed response to your question, because at first it got attention, I think, partly because it was pretty exclusive in terms of the footage, you know, from Iraq. Very, very few television networks and very, very few filmmakers had gone there, the one exception being John Pilger, who produced a documentary called Paying the Price. I think the subtitle was Killing the People of Iraq. And he talked about the sanctions and that sort of thing, but he didn't really get very much access to just regular people in the streets and in their homes and things like that. And by way of Voices in the Wilderness, which was an activist group from Chicago, I was able to get access to, you know, just everyday folks doing everyday things and trying to survive under all of the different horrible circumstances that they were living under. And I think because of that, you know, it's Missile Street got some attention. And then, as you mentioned, probably about maybe like 6 to 9 months after it was released, the Bush administration started beating the drum to try to, you know, get U.S. public support for the idea of going in and blasting Iraq out of the water and, you know, unseating Saddam Hussein and so on. And so that kind of added to the interest. And I mean, from late summer, early fall of 2001, all the way until March of 2003, when the invasion actually took place, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I was all over the place showing the documentary and doing Q&A and that sort of thing. And Voices in the Wilderness used it for, you know, grassroots screenings and discussions. And Voices office in London used it there. So it was seen pretty extensively in a lot of different countries through various means, you know, whether satellite TV or grassroots screenings, or it was in some film festivals. So, you know, that was, and of course, it has one of your great songs right at the end called "My Daughter," and you know, I shot this adorable. She was 5 years old. This adorable. Little Iraqi girl, and she's kind of like kind of looking at the camera and then looking away and looking back at the camera, and the lyrics of that song of yours really fit the situation. You know, it's like if people were just able to see or look at this little person as, you know, maybe their daughter. I mean, she's somebody's daughter. And maybe they'd stop and think about what was happening to Iraqi civilians in large part because of the sanctions that we were continuing to impose. And then, as you said, YouTube came along, and I didn't even put, as a matter of fact, I think Missile Street still isn't on YouTube. It's on Vimeo. And I didn't put Out of Balance, which was released toward the end of 2006 or early 2007. I didn't even put that out there on YouTube until maybe a year or two ago.
Did it become a lot less likely that people would be doing screenings and taking more initiative to kind of get a film out there, or did it become more like the atmosphere changed where people were like, oh, okay, people can just watch that on YouTube, tell them to go see it on YouTube? I mean, kind of everything got cheapened in a way in terms of the kind of work that you do. Was that something that you experienced as a result of YouTube?
You know, I think to a certain extent, yeah, you know, but I don't know that YouTube has really like killed the, either the grassroots screening and talk thing, because it's kind of a community thing, or, you know, a lot of churches, a lot of schools, including colleges, that hosted me, with both of those two films. And I don't know that necessarily has been completely obliterated by YouTube. It definitely has had something, you know, kind of taken away from the whole thing because of what you just said. You know, people know, or at least expect, that they can just go out on YouTube and find it and watch it for free. That's unfortunate, you know, for not only me, but any number of different types of artists, whether they're filmmakers or musicians or what have you, who, you know, so that they're not necessarily able to make any money. I mean, from what I understand, you've got to have a lot of subscribers and a lot of views of a lot of minutes to even start making some money.
Anything, yeah. I've heard that 98% of documentaries lose money. That and that statistic is a few years old, but like mm-hmm. And of course, I guess most people making a documentary, you wouldn't even expect to ever make money on it, right? You go about fundraising to try to fund the project, and then you do the project, and then when you put it out there, if you can make a little money back from your investment, then then you consider yourself lucky generally, right? I mean, is that about fair? And has it become harder and harder to fundraise over the course of your career? Would that be an accurate statement?
It has. And I think there's some additional reasons for that. I mean, for a while, maybe back around the turn of the decade from the zeros to the tens, Kickstarter and Indiegogo and pages like that became very popular for trying to raise money to make independent documentaries and things like that. And I'm sure that there are still some people who try to use those platforms to do that, or maybe something like Patreon. But you know, I never have had a whole lot of success with those platforms. And I think part of it is because they became so kind of saturated with that type of thing that it sort of turned some people away, and for those who weren't turned away, it was that much harder for, you know, for somebody to find their work and their fundraising. Another thing that happened with me was I actually kind of stopped being interested in that type of thing because of something that happened with a fundraising trailer for what was going to be a sort of follow-up to Out of Balance. I called it At Any Cost. And without going into too much detail, some things that happened related to that afterwards kind of brought me to a point where I understood a little bit more why some filmmakers are very secretive and don't do things like putting fundraising trailers out on YouTube and connecting them on Kickstarter and things like that. Because, you know, they don't want to reveal too much about what they're doing in case somebody else comes along and decides, oh, that's a good idea, because you don't have any legal protections in terms of, you know, telling true stories in documentary form, at least in terms of the subject matter. I guess you have some legal protections in terms of how you choose to tell the story. But even then, it's only when you know, you need to take all these different sort of legal protections like copywriting and that sort of thing, which I didn't do at the time. And so, you know, ever since then, I've been a lot more protective and don't put things like fundraising trailers out there for anybody to see. And, you know, just so that I don't wind up feeling as though maybe somebody kind of took the general idea and ran with it.
Yeah, right. So. You know, when I look at the different things that you've done, documentaries, the different subjects that you've done documentaries about, I mean, when you do a documentary, it pretty clearly you're spending a lot of time and effort on the project, and I assume it becomes like one of your babies, and that doesn't change later, right? It's still your baby. They're all your babies. And then I'm sure that you then also naturally are keeping more close track of what's going on in those places, because of course you've met people in the course of making these documentaries. I mean, going to Gaza, going to Iraq, obviously. And then when I look at basically at least 80% of the things you've done documentaries about, everything's just gotten so much worse, you know? You know, I mean, you know, like since you did Greetings from Missile Street, and since then the country has been completely destroyed at least like a couple times. I mean, you did the documentary about 9/11 responders, many of whom, the people you interviewed, probably died of cancer within a decade or so after you talked to them. I'll bet lots of them are dead now. I think something like half of them died within 10 years of the first responders there. It was just astounding.
They certainly know. The ones who were in that video, as far as I know, all of them are still with us.
Wow.
But they, all of them know a number of other first responders who have died since then.
Have you been back to Iraq or Gaza since you made those films?
No. And not for, you know, not for any lack of desire to do so, especially Iraq. Well, yeah, there's the expense involved.
Dangerous, not to mention dangerous, depending on which year you might have been thinking of going. Or
right. Yeah. I mean, it's there was definitely a level of danger, even at the times that I went to those places. Mm. But it's more of a case. I mean, I've talked with Kathy Kelly, who was the sort of de facto head of Voices in the Wilderness, now Voices for Creative Nonviolence. I've talked to her a number of times over the last several years. And from time to time, you know, we'll talk about, you know, what's sort of the latest in terms of, you know, just checking in and seeing if she had gone back there, which she did at first. She was one of the people who were there when the U.S. bombs started to fly in 2003. But since then, she has not been back, as far as I know. And, you know, it's for a lot of different reasons, not only the danger, but, you know, it's just, it's such a different sort of setting there now in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, I know she has been to Afghanistan many, many times, and I think she's been to Gaza and places like that. But it's, you know, it's for a lot of different reasons why I haven't had the chance to do that. Although I have kept touch with a number of people, and same with Nicaragua. You know, I did a documentary from a trip there, and I think it was 2003 or 2004, with an activist group that was protesting. The president there was that conservative for a couple of years. I can't remember his name right now, but he was apparently negotiating with companies like Coca-Cola and Nestle to basically sell those companies the Nicaraguan water supply.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sell the aquifers. Which I'm sure was a nice thought for Nestle, but not for people in Nicaragua. And, you know, they organized and protested it. And as it turned out, that was a successful protest. That sale didn't happen unless it happened without anybody knowing it. But I don't think it did.
Yeah, that film about defending the commons, that's one right. of those potential silver linings there in terms of the other subjects you've done films about. Because,
yeah.
I mean, certainly, like, there's been a lot more since you did the film. There's been even more talk about the whole subject of what belongs to the commons and what belongs in private. And then with the whole tech revolution, this whole question takes on all kinds of other new dimensions, right? In terms of social media and who owns these posts and who's profiting off of all this free content that the people are constantly putting up on these corporate platforms, you know, that then make advertising profits from it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But you're right. I mean, that defending the commons is kind of a rare exception when you look at the other subjects that I've tried to look into and present, you know, voices from perspectives that we don't otherwise hear here in mainstream media, certainly. And that was true with Missile Street. You know, put out Missile Street, it got a fair amount of attention, and lo and behold, you know, the Bush-Cheney cabal invades and occupies in March of 2003. Let's see what else. As you said, Worlds Apart, about the 9/11 sort of peacemaker first responders, small group of people. You know, I mean, we're still in Afghanistan. Our military is still in Afghanistan, you know, there wasn't any sort of nonviolent response to what happened on 9/11. And same, I mean, you can go down the list. Out of balance, you know, it was especially shocking and perturbing, if that's a word, to me, that Rex Tillerson, who is mentioned fairly prominently in Out of Balance, you know, we
got CEO him on, of ExxonMobil,
got mm-hmm. him on camera. Yeah, you know, we filmed we're one of the cameras at the press conference after the ExxonMobil shareholders meeting in 2006. So that was his first year as president and CEO. You know, lo and behold, he becomes the Secretary of State for Trump. You know, that's not an accident, but it is. It's very frustrating when you put that much into yourself and give that much to try to, you know, get a story out that that is kind of a little bit of a warning to people in different ways. And you know, in the end, our government winds up, you know, pulling the different things that they've pulled over the last 20 years since I've been directing documentaries. And yeah, it's frustrating, but at the same time, you know, I mean, I've been working for a few years on a follow-up to Out of Balance, called, not surprisingly, called Still Out of Balance.
That's good.
And, you know, I'm hoping that once, if we, assuming that we ever get the pandemic under better control, and I think we will, that, and I'll continue and finish that off and then put that out there. And it may be in a different form, you know, maybe a small pay per view or something on YouTube or some other platform, just so I can, you know, because you're right. You invest a lot into it, and documentaries, generally speaking, with only a few exceptions, documentary filmmakers are in it for the love of the work and the concern and commitment that they have to the different ideas that they want to put into a documentary, and not thinking that they're going to, you know, make a boatload of money out of it. But
yeah. You know. All right. Tom, as you, you mentioned your white hair, and you know, I think it's something that I'm, you know, 53, and you know, I look forward to having many decades ahead of me in what I hope will be a long and productive life still. Yep. But I'm definitely like probably at least that, you know, in all likelihood somewhere, you know, maybe halfway or past halfway. And I think you get to that point and you start thinking about like, what have you been doing all this time? And it's all, I think, for many people of you know, sort of anyone maybe under the age of 80, I'd say, you know, at this point, you kind of look at everything you've been doing. If you're a left winger trying to make the world a more equitable place in one way or another, and less imperialist place, and whatever else, and then you see, you know, basically things are pretty consistently going in the wrong direction, with the exception of maybe Bolivia, you know, and you know, I mean, Uruguay. I mean, you know, there's some exceptions out there, but generally, yeah. You know, I mean, the pink tide in Latin America was a very hopeful moment. I mean, there's hopeful moments. There's good. There's social movements. There's things. There's times like, you know, where things are looking hopeful. Occupy Wall Street, the global justice movement. Where, you know, we may be, you know, not the things are going in the wrong direction, but things look hopeful. There's when it's always exciting when there's a social movement, but generally. The trajectory is not positive. And how is that something that occupies your brain much of the time, or are you just trying not to think about it too much?
Yeah, it does definitely occupy my brain. I mean, I've always been sort of a news junkie anyway. I mean, really, since I was like in high school, at least, if not even before that. And I can't imagine, you know, as tempting as it might seem, or I'll hear somebody else who's just like, yeah, you know, I just don't worry about that anymore. Frankly, there's a few people who were very involved in the climate change issue, who I got to know back in the first decade of the 2000s, who are kind of, you know, not particularly focused on it anymore. And it's not because they don't care, and it's not because you know, they're being lazy or anything like that. It's just they became so frustrated by the situation, and so kind of beaten down by the far right reaction and how that spread and grew, if anything, that you know, I think they just got to a point where they had enough. And you know, I find that very sad and tragic, but also, you know, I can understand how some people might be led in that direction, considering, you know, all that has happened in the past 20 years, when a lot of people have been trying to get people to listen about that issue. But for me, I don't think that I, you know, that's I know the, you know, I'm not hardwired like that or whatever. It's kind of a cheap expression. But I think it's also true. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, just shutting off the and never accessing the news or progressive sources of information, researching things online. It's just so much a part of me that I, you know, I can't even begin to imagine just not doing it. And it's not that I don't ever feel frustrated. It's not that I have any sort of, you know, fantastic source of hope that keeps coming back. It's just too much of who, you know, who I am. And having been through my 50s now, recently through, I totally recognize those feelings of, you know, kind of looking back, what have I done? What am I doing now? What do I think I'm going to do for, you know, however much time remains. And like you, I hope that there's a lot. You know, I can't really imagine sort of making myself just tune out on things. And that's what it would have to be. I would have to make a real conscious effort to tune out and just not access any sort of information sources or anything like that. And I can't even begin to imagine actually doing that. So therefore, I probably will also always want to try to, you know, raise my voice and work with people in different capacities, whether it's in a documentary video or on a podcast, and try to help in whatever way that may help, even if it's a small way, to try to get their voices out there as well. And, you know, that's just,
yeah, absolutely. Mm. When you mentioned being a news junkie, Tom, you know, I'm also a news junkie, but the experience of the pandemic, coming on for me was, an experience of, basically, I became much more of a news junkie, which I didn't even think was, you know, really possible. But I've been glued. I mean, I've had something in my ear most of the time, day and night, you know, with, you know, broadcasts from around the world, trying to figure out, you know, trying to keep track of what's going on. And even as a chronic, you know, decades long news junkie, it's been challenging. And so for me to keep track of what's been happening. And so, And then, you know, and part of what's been, what I'm keeping track of is vitally important information for anybody in this country or in this city or whatever, because so much of the news, you know, at least related to the pandemic, it's things like, okay, here's this loan you can apply for. Here's what's the deal with gig workers and unemployment. I mean, it's stuff you need to know. And then, you know, mixed in with all this stuff you may or may not need to know, but you're going to be finding out about, you know. And I just, I mean, the number of people who are not news junkies, I mean, it's hard to even imagine how overwhelmed they must be feeling by the constant array, you know, the constant inundation. You know. Somebody on somebody watching is wondering on YouTube is wondering how do you stick to the facts while making a documentary and not let your bias come in, knowing you're passionate about your project.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know what I've tended to do is I will find a particular issue that matters to me. You know, I started to learn about what was happening in Iraq and the effects of economic sanctions sometime in the mid to late 90s. And, you know, just started doing a lot of researching and listening to various voices, at least the ones that were addressing the issue, which was not a whole lot of voices at that point. You know, listening to Kathy Kelly and what she had to say about it. And, I think it does take maybe a certain level of discernment, and verifying factual information to the best of your ability, given the availability of the facts. So there again, you know, with an issue like ExxonMobil and climate change, you know, I had been keeping an eye on them for a long time since the Valdez oil spill. And, you know, I think a lot of times it requires accessing some non-commercial studies and non-commercial media, because to me, that's where the dangerous biases come in. And a lot of people see that stuff. And I'm not just talking about so-called conservative media, which is just heinously biased and non-factual across the board. But also, you know, other types of commercial media, they also have a tendency to leave a lot of facts out and off the table, especially facts that they think or know are going to piss off their paying customers, you know, their sponsors. That's the lifeblood of that type of media. So seeking out especially non-commercial sources of information, I think, has been a big part of you know, finding the facts. And, you know, if I got to a point, let's say hypothetically, that I was focused on a particular issue, and sure, of course, I would have my opinion. But if I found that in going through those different sources for factual information, if I found that, you know, it's actually not kind of the way I was concerned about, or that you know, anthropogenic climate change was in fact just a big hoax or something like that, then I wouldn't continue with the production, or maybe I would, you know, make a very different production. You know, if I felt compelled to continue with it, you know, it's possible that I would completely change course.
But generally starting on a premise that's already clear, like, okay, yeah, the sanctions are killing people in Iraq. We know that. Yeah. Now let's see, how bad is it? You know, not a question of, is it happening, right? Or climate change, it's happening. Right. It's man-made and it's happening, and Exxon's a big part of the problem. How much of a big problem is it? Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And, you know, so I've never felt like, oh, this is completely biased or something like that. And then, you know, another thing that I do pretty routinely is I always have sources of information including usually some lawyers. Not that lawyers have all the answers for anything, but they will root out something that where they think, you know, okay, this could be construed as you stating a fact that's actually not true, and you could be sued for defamation or something like that. And so, you know, a couple of attorneys took a good hard look at Out of Balance before it was released, just to make sure that some of the allegations that I make in there were actually supported by fact, if I was stating them as facts, that they were actually supported by verifiable facts. And so, you know, everything in there is factual, and it wasn't sort of like born out of some bias. If anything, it made me more biased, if that's what you want to call it. It made me feel like this is something that I really want people to know about. You know, I want people to know that they have supported and funded the so-called skeptics back then. Now we call them deniers of climate change. And that was all in things like, for example, because ExxonMobil was and still is a publicly traded company on the stock market, they have to release information, for example, about where they make donations and give money. So, you know, I and also people like Kurt Davies at Greenpeace at the time found all these different names of organizations out of which many of the so-called skeptics who got on all kinds of networks. Back then, it was all of the commercial networks that they were getting on and denying the problem completely. So, yeah, you know, it's I've never felt as though, and I'm just sort of trying to support some sort of bias at all.
And this is an interesting question. I'm just reading it now. Somebody else, how do you shoot in a geography where you don't speak the language? You may miss out on local moods your host crew may not notify you about. Yeah, mm-hmm. Any comments on filming in a place where you don't speak the language? Has that been a particular challenge? Or do you speak Arabic?
Shwaya, shwaya.
I know how to say shwaya, shwaya. Yeah.
There have been times when it was challenging, for sure. But generally speaking, there have been people either there or people who were part of a delegation, you know, as with Voices, who knew more Arabic than I did, and people there in Iraq who knew quite a bit of English. And where that didn't work, then, you know, sign language and things like that kind of were helpful at times. But in addition to that, sometimes we would come across somebody who was very, very fluent. So, for example, in Missile Street, there's an interview with an artist, Kasim Absalti. And, you know, I wanted to interview an artist. He's pretty prominent and still is in Iraq, and also opinionated. He speaks almost no English. But we found one of his students, one of his art students, who told me that he had learned English, and he was quite fluent. He told me he had learned English all from watching movies. Watching movies in English.
You hear about these people all over the world.
It's incredible. And I have had really, really good fortune in terms of being connected with people who either speak the language as native speakers or have learned it. So, you know, in Nicaragua, a guy named Mike Boudreau, who was one of the founders of Compass de Nicaragua, totally fluent in English and Spanish. And he was a tremendous help to me, you know, throughout the time that I was there. in Gaza, Ibrahim al-Shatali. He was very, very, you know, not 100% fluent in English, but as it turns out, he was just one of these people who seemed to know everybody in Gaza City. It was incredible. You know, you're just going around, hey, Ibrahim. He seemed to know everyone and you know, was just tremendously helpful. Whether it was, you know, during interviews with people who didn't speak any English, you know, he kind of helped to translate and that sort of thing, making connections and all that sort of thing. So, you know, I've had a lot of good fortune in terms of connecting with people like that wherever I've gone, either before I get there or after I get there. And that's something to certainly, you know, help anybody who wants to go and make a film like that in a place where you don't speak the language. Yeah, I mean, otherwise, I'm sure there would have been problems. And you know, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, the one time that I got kind of yelled at in a language that I didn't speak was actually at a film festival in Greece, where Out of Balance was screened. And they were very generous in terms of, you know, enabling me to go there and actually, you know, appear and talk with people live and in person. So the organizers were wonderful. And I sent them a transcript from the entire film, and they said that they were going to translate it into Greek and caption the film. Well, I got there, and this hall, you know, this big hall was packed with people, and they showed the film, and they hadn't captioned it.
Ah!
And so as soon as they brought me up front, there were some people yelling at me in Greek, you know, asking why the hell I hadn't captioned it so that they could better understand it. And I'm just
yeah, good question.
I sent the transcript, you know. Anyway,
wow. That's so awful.
That was an interesting situation, but generally, you know, I don't know if it's luck or what it is, but I've had good luck in terms of connecting with people who can translate and who have been very helpful in terms of getting around in these different places.
Tom, any predictions for what's going to happen in the next few weeks in the United States, finally?
Yeah. you know, that is something that's really been wearing on me, frankly.
A lot of death.
That and also just the incredibly reprehensible behavior of this egomaniac that is continuing to try to become the country's first full-fledged dictator, and, you know, destroy whatever semblance of democracy was remaining in the country. You know, I've had the feeling that when he discovered that he wasn't actually going to win, rather than taking that as a revival of a little bit of breath in the democratic process remaining here, he decided that it was to look at it as an opportunity to stick to his guns and try to kill the little bit that was remaining somehow. And you know, I can't even begin to describe how outrageous I think that is, and it makes me amazed that there are still as many people supporting him as there are, and any politicians of any persuasion who are supporting him. As far as I'm concerned, it's like a traitorous slant to be taking on the country.
That's coming from a man in a state whose license plate says "Live Free or Die." So.
yeah, the New Hampshire libertarian sort of streak. yeah. But, you know, I think just because of some of the things that have been happening in the last couple of days, for example, I read this morning that his legal team dropped out of the vote count legal action that that he had had them bring in Pennsylvania.
It's just totally frivolous.
Yeah. It's garbage. And, you know, I do think that ultimately he will wind up leaving. It may be, you know, last minute or whatever. But he'll continue to, you know, yell and scream about how he actually won. And probably start, you know, a media company. And if he thinks he's going to be prosecuted, he'll start it from Moscow. And if he thinks he can avoid being prosecuted, then he'll do it here. And
that's a very interesting prediction. That's the first prediction of that particular that particular prediction is the first time I've heard that one, and I bet it's very spot on.
Yeah.
Let's see if Trump starts a media company based in Moscow. That would be a fascinating next step.
You know, I mean, I don't think there's any extradition possibility.
Nope.
If he was there. Nope. He probably, if he can buddy up to Vladdy enough, he can probably build the tower that he's always wanted to build there. And at the same time, you know, start his media empire, and you know, spread more lies and insanity.
It's about right.
That's my prediction.
Tom, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining me.
Always good to talk with you, David. And thank you, as always, for your amazing songwriting and your activism. And I will be looking forward, as always, to more new music whenever you release it.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon, Tom.
All right. Thanks.
And thanks, everybody, for joining me in this discussion with filmmaker Tom Jackson. And if you want to check out his films and podcast, joepublicfilms.com. And to the person on YouTube who had more questions, please email or send Tom a message. He'll be happy to hear from you, I'm sure. But thanks for those very good questions as well. And if you want to see this interview in archived form, you can go to youtube.com/drovics, and you'll see there's a Discussions with David playlist. You can also find it on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance in the video section, as well as in the video section and on the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio. And in podcast form, if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. And I will be back with more live stream interviews next week on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, right here on this platform, as well as in podcast form. And on the 28th, at the end, the last Saturday of the month at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, I'll be doing a little concert from my living room, which is a last Saturday tradition at this point here in this household. All right, everybody, remember, don't pay the rent, trust your neighbors, mutual aid will get us through, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.